You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, ahead of next week's Super Tuesday, many predict that the Trump train is now unstoppable. So with no fellow Republicans willing to take him on, what might happen when or if Hillary Clinton eventually does? Meanwhile, in the GOP, senators are uniting behind a plan of complete inaction as they stare down President Barack Obama's potential Supreme Court pick. Plus, can an EU-wide migration plan ever work? Assad and Putin shine a light of possibility on a Syrian ceasefire, and would you invest in Russia? We'll look at how the tumbling price of oil is changing the financial landscape. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are the journalist Samira Shackle and Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard here in London. Welcome both. Now, the process of feigning surprise when Donald Trump defies yet another expert prediction has become rather a painful lather, rinse and repeat habit. This week's caucuses in Nevada saw him claim victory in yet another state, edging him firmly into odds-on territory for the Republican nomination. Not for the first time, Trump's cause has been aided by the unwillingness or inability of his rivals to confront him directly. But at some point, somebody surely will, and that somebody is increasingly likely to be Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee for president. So how will Trump deal with his former wedding guest? Samira, I'll ask you first. So far, Trump has basically just, waved off every criticism by declaiming a sequence of belligerent non-sequiturs. Can he debate with Hillary Clinton the same way?
I think that's a really good summary, belligerent non-sequiturs, and that's kind of the thing that makes him very difficult to debate with, I think. So sort of faced with quite reasonable questions about his inconsistent and pretty wild stances, he'll often just respond with ad hominem attacks or complete non-sequiturs, as you've said. So I think that it's interesting because to the support base that he's got, that's very appealing. They see someone sort of not playing the game, just sort of sticking two fingers up to the establishment, etc. But whether that approach translates into a broader base appeal amongst the wider electorate remains to be seen. And I think in terms of debating Clinton, we can expect a heavy dose of misogyny judging by his performance in the televised debates thus far.
Indeed so. But, I mean, Robert, is the two fingers that Samira describes there, is basically the problem that Hillary or any opponent that he will face has, that all the usual things that would count as a win in a debate, sort of like finding him out, scoring points, pointing out factual inaccuracies, he doesn't care.
Yeah, but I think when it comes to Hillary also, that he'll play another thing, as Samira hinted. He'll play that she is the establishment. She is the establishment that let you down. Look what a terrible time we had, Obama. Think back to the Clintons. He's the peer of smear. He's very, very, he's very, very good at that. And that's how he works. His constituency is talk radio shows, shock jocks, Rush Limbaugh. That's the way it works. It seems to me there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times this morning about somebody from the 18th century and not the US, Immanuel Kant. And I think that this piece, which was extremely well argued by a behavioral psychologist, not a philosopher, to me suddenly shone a light as to what is going on, as to what is going on with Trump, as to what is going on in the EU debate. And it's about the anger that the opponents, the opposition, were against the establishment in the UK. People who are from the establishment, because they're for pulling out of the EU, are managing to paint themselves, like Donald Trump, as being against the establishment. And the argument is simply this. It's Kant's argument about obligation, which he said is related. You feel obliged and will act on an obligation according to ability. And the argument, really, of the psychologists isn't that. It is actually according to guilt and blame. And it's a blame game we're in. And that's where Trump scores with people for all kinds of reasons, often very legitimate, feel marginalized. We haven't got a fair deal. rage against the centre. And I think that this is why he's successful. This is why I don't know the states as well as either of you two do, I suspect. But I suspect that I feel in my gut that this blame game, which comes from the Rush Limbaugh culture, will go on because it is so prominent. It's so prevalent in the debate in Europe about the two things, not about membership, but also about migrants, which we're going to come on to discuss. Somebody is to blame for our misfortune.
Samira, if you are, you know, part of Hillary Clinton's team trying to figure out how you go about preparing to debate against Donald Trump, would she maybe just be thinking that if it comes down to a choice between her and whatever else you will say about Hillary Clinton, she is an experienced politician, mm-hmm. she knows what she's doing, she's a grown-up who has done a grown-up's job. Will she just be thinking, faced with this ludicrous blowhard, all she has to do is just not swing, just walk in a straight line, mm-hmm. and there's enough basically sane, independent, centrist people in America that they will elect her?
Yeah, I would imagine that's probably the main tactic. I mean, it seems really difficult as from an outside perspective looking in on the US primary process at the moment. It sort of beggars belief that Donald Trump is even doing so well, just when it, not even the sort of patent bigotry of what he's saying, but just the sheer lack of any clear policies, any talk about sort of implementation of any of the things he's suggesting. And you know, that's even apart from the pretty heinous statements he's made on various different subjects, sort of gender and race and immigration, not least among them. And I think that does speak to sort of anger. But, you know, I think as you say, and as I said earlier, the when you're looking at the general population, that's a very different matter to looking at the people who are voting in the Republican primaries. And I think that's something that the Republican establishment are very aware of. That's why they're, I think, quite terrified about the way that the primaries seem to be going, because there's been, it seems to be that the people voting in the primaries are electing someone who is probably not going to play that well with the public at large. And I would imagine that's probably Clinton's team's strategy, just sort of don't waver and hope that people see sense. Because, it's a case of two radically different options, to the point that it must be very difficult to even think about how you debate with someone like Trump.
Very quickly, there's an obvious antidote to Trump. And it's not Hillary Clinton, it's Bill Clinton. If they can get Bill back to a quarter of his strength, and he was very, very good at turning the flank of these people. Look, remember when he got a hostile Congress led by Gingrich, the way he handled it, it is by charm, by chutzpah, and by very, very quick wit. It's very Brit to say this, you know, people brought up on Oscar Wilde and P.G. Woodhouse and Lewis Carroll. Look, Hillary, frankly, is not one of the world's great wits, is she? And that is the problem, is that, you know, she is deadly serious, a bit too earnest at times, and that is meat and drink to Trump's trumpeting. But I do think, I am serious about this, Team Clinton, Chelsea is not to be ruled out as a strategist. I think they could work it out, and they could expose him with more than a gentle dose of irony. What Samira said is absolutely true. It's very interesting. The biggest opposition to Trump, and I was reading an excellent piece this morning, is coming from the New York establishment, saying he didn't count here, he wasn't terribly good, the business career was up and down. But that isn't middle America. And, you know, for Cruz, for the others, one of the astonishing things was how he captured the Hispanic vote. Which was not, with Rubio, was expected to, they were his folk. But it just didn't work this time, particularly in Nevada.
Well, we will stay with the increasingly odd Republican Party for the moment, because it seems that the GOP has conjured a cunning plan ahead of President Barack Obama's likely nomination for a new Supreme Court justice to replace the late Antonin Scalia. Whatever happens, say nothing and do nothing. Senate Republican leaders say there will be no confirmation hearings, no vote, not even a courtesy meeting with Obama's nominee, whoever that turns out to be. At which point, I'm inclined to cede the floor to Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware, who said, for the Senate of the United States to simply go na 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 na, that's not advise and consent. That's an elementary school response, not a grown-up response. Samira, is Senator Coons wrong?
No, I totally agree with that. And it's just the latest symptom of this sort of really ugly partisanship that's plagued the US, certainly throughout Obama's tenure, if not before, but it's been really just sort of increasing. We had the congressional shutdown in 2013, and it just seems like another manifestation of that same thing. And it's difficult to see it being anything other than incredibly unappealing to the public. You see the Republicans sort of trying to claim that they are... That Obama would be wrong, but I think they've been quite gleefully quoting a speech by Biden in 1992 urging Bush not to appoint in a sort of equivalent situation, not to appoint a judge until after the presidential election. But the difference there is, you know, as the senator aptly put it, they're not putting their fingers in their ears and chanting. The Republicans aren't simply asking that Obama put the decision off. They're sort of questioning his right to even make a nomination, let alone, you know, they're not even making any question about the candidate themselves.
I mean, it's bizarre. It is quite mad, because President Barack Obama remains president until such time as his successor is sworn in. The longest ever confirmation of a Supreme Court justice was 125 days. There is all the time in the world to confirm a new judge. Robert, from the Republicans' own point of view, is there any apparent strategic logic to this, or are they just now so entrenched in a reflex of just saying no to everything that this is what they've done before actually thinking?
Well, the vilification of Obama is not just principle, if you can find any of that in this. It is prejudice. And it has been a very, very ugly side of this. And there are right-wing commentators, by that I don't mean to say that they're pejorative, a very thoughtful conservative commentator, should I say, like David Brooks, wrote very, very eloquently last week and said, in the disgusting displays by the Republicans right across the piece, he was saying, of the candidates, he said, I'm a natural GOP supporter. Look at the dignity of the Obamas, plural. Mm. All of that they've been thrown, and particularly Michelle, you know, hasn't put a foot wrong. There's hardly been a duff appointment. There has been no whiff of scandal, financial or otherwise. And I think it's a very serious thing. And I think that the commentariat right across the piece of namely, to absolutely say, because you are a president of the stripe that we don't like, we're going to bust the Constitution, which is what the Republicans have been saying. And I think that, again, as you say, we get a blowback into the Trump candidacy, waterboard them, carpet bomb them. Obama has just announced he intends, before he leaves office, to close Guantanamo Bay for very obvious reasons. It was one of his initial pleasures. I'd keep it open, you know. What kind of playground politics is this?
I mean, and it is, as Chris Coon said, literally playground politics. Samira, I mean, from your point of view, can you see any actual strategic coherence to this? Because there is, of course, the delicious possibility it might even backfire on them if President Clinton does end up choosing the next Supreme Court justice and picks someone they might like even less. I mean, if she does have a sense of humour, she would, of course, nominate Barack Obama for the vacancy.
Yeah. But he'd be very good.
But he would as well. But is there a strategic logic discernible here?
I mean, I don't think that there is really, beyond the obstructionism against Obama, which has been a really consistent feature of the last sort of 7 or 8 years. I think the only thing is the question of the political stripe of the head of the judiciary, I guess. I mean, they don't want someone who's a liberal. Scalia made numerous sort of quite conservative decisions on issues like reproductive rights. I don't think they necessarily want to see the tide of those judgments turn, which again is quite it's quite ugly, really, because you know, it's sort of ingrained into any student of Western liberal democracy that the judiciary shouldn't be quite so politicized. So, I mean, I think that's the only discernible strategic goal, but I think there's a lot more about it's just sort of trying to treat Obama as if he's already out, basically, sort of obstructing at all possible moments.
Well, we are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Samira Shackle and Robert Fox. Coming up next, as Assad and Putin trade pleasantries over the telephone, the price of oil obliterates Russian investment, and can an EU-wide migration plan ever really happen? Short answer, no. Longer answer, coming up after this.
Monocle's annual Quality of Life Conference returns this April for 3 days of great conversations, inspiring panellists and peerless hosting. Set in Vienna, the conference will pull together people who care about running better businesses, brands, design studios, cities, and even nations, and who are looking for global inspiration and new benchmarks for success. Up for discussion will be the future of communication in a world overwhelmed by digital content, How to Make a Nation. Monocle is launching this brand new book in Austria and will be bringing some star names from diplomacy, government and business to explain how good countries can deliver on quality of life for all. And we'll hear from players from around the globe who've discovered that you can create jobs and wealth with downtown ateliers and the sound of the odd hammer. Speakers such as chef and food writer Bill Granger, co-founder and director of Vienna Design Week Lily Holein, and the journalist and writer Gianni Riotta will share the stage with Monocle's editors and many, many more. Running from Friday afternoon to Sunday, with a focus on a full Saturday schedule, the conference is designed as a live event with elements broadcast here on Monocle 24. In between the debates, there'll be plenty of time to meet the editors, speakers, sponsors, and also your fellow readers and listeners. For more information and tickets, visit monocle.com. Be part of the discussion at the Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2016 from April 15th to the 17th. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Robert Fox. Now, despite the significant clue in the name, the European Union is often not very good at uniting behind a common concern. There is perhaps presently no greater example of that than the migration crisis, about which the only point of agreement among the EU's member states is that some or other member states should deal with it. But as various nations continue to build walls, literally and otherwise, senior officials in Brussels are said to be considering a plan to reignite a shared European approach to the migration issue. Details remain unsurprisingly unclear, but it does provide a hint that some influential figures remain committed to a Europe-wide solution. Samira, the easy question first, even with the best of political wills, is there actually a Europe-wide solution?
I mean, I think you mean is there one that's possible?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that is the only real way to mediate the crisis, I think, is to have some sort of system whereby the burden of refugees is spread out between countries, where the flow of people is managed, where you're logging people who are coming in and going out and distributing them across countries in a fair and reasonable way, and keeping track of where they are and giving them some sort of temporary visa so that they can go home when the conflicts are over or whatever it is, and have the right to work and contribute to the societies they're in. And I think it's absolutely bonkers that that's not being done, because not only is it the humane thing to do, it's also just the only conceivable practical thing to do, because, you know, people aren't going to stop coming. It's people are coming because they've been displaced. It's the biggest displacement of people for absolutely decades. And so, you know, people are going to keep coming. So why not keep track of where they are? Don't force them into these really dangerous routes, and don't force them into entering illegally. Keep track of them, distribute them, and yeah, I just think that's the only way to solve it.
That is, of course, the common sense solution in an ideal world. Unfortunately, the unideal world we live in is often rather lacking in common sense. Robert, is something like that actually practical, or do European political leaders, will they just continually run up against domestic hostility from their own constituencies? Because basically, the give or take the odd moment of sympathy, sort of occasioned by, you know, something especially ghastly by the standards of this ghastly story happening, public sympathy does not appear to be overwhelming. Most people just seem to want the refugees and migrants to go somewhere else.
The answer to your three questions is yes, yes, yeah. And yes. Yes, Samira, absolutely, it can only be done on a European-wide basis. And what Samira was pointing at was a strategic contextual conception of it. I get very, very little of that, even from people who really are thinking deeply and hard about it, like Angela Merkel. We're just at the beginning of this thing. As I bang the table here, metaphorically, at Midori House, week after week, I've been looking at mass flows across the Mediterranean, which have been subtle and not to this great degree, for 30 years. This has been on the move. Things have been moving, and suddenly it moves, like an ice shelf or a glacier, for 50 or 60 years. It's to do with demography, now being driven by climate change, globalisation, the catalyst of Moore's Law playing into that, and communications.
It's a bit like that old joke about bankruptcy, that it happens very slowly and then very quickly.
We can have a civilised conversation about this. I hear nothing of this in the debates in great places and high parliaments and councils and chancelleries, which is a great, great problem. You don't really hear about this in the UN, because it's why the yes to your other two questions. It is because Europe is fracturing. And one of the main points of which EU-Europe is fracturing is on this. Exactly as Samira was saying, that you have the ins and outs, you have Hungary and the UK pretending that it isn't their problem and somebody else can deal with it. It belongs to another world, for example. And there is, again, it refers back to what I was saying about the kind of sympathy you get for Donald Trump and the out vote, the out of the EU vote in the UK, is that people are scared. Yep. And they're scared about changing demography, and they're scared about the changing shape of society. The fact of demography is that we are going to have to face the prospect of what does, in the present organisation and disorganisation of its continental economy, what does an Africa of 5.5 billion look like within 30 or 40 or 50 years? It is going to come to Europe's doorstep. This is the way these things work. And the trouble is that, I will stop my banging the table ranting here, that the toolbox is so inappropriate. I listened to excellent talks and discussions about the use of modern anthropology and social anthropology, human geography, and applied economics, and even behavioural psychology. All this has to come into the picture, but I'm damned if I can find it in most of the stuff, because I think there's a very interesting point. A book I'm very keen on, my book of the month, and I'm interviewing the author very soon, I hope you do, on Midori House, is David Kilcullen, hard-nosed Australian soldier, but a serious strategic thinker. And his book on Blood Year, what we've gone through in the last year, and he takes the refugee crisis related to Syria and Iraq into consideration. He makes a very simple point. It's not in the old military maxim that we're reinforcing failure. Most of the solutions reinforce the past. Mm. They don't anticipate the present into the future. And the kind of thing that Samira was talking about is that's the way we're going to do it. We're going to have to do it collectively. We're going to have to absorb. We're going to have to actually encourage return at various points. But at some point, we have got to get governance into the picture, because refugee movements, these highly articulate people at the top end, they must take responsibility for their own leadership and their own destination and destiny, and not blame it on other people.
Samira, is there, you know, Robert talks about, you know, encouraging people to return when that's possible. Is, in terms of engaging with political reality, might it actually help Europe to absorb the people who are in genuinely desperate need, especially the people of Syria who don't really have a country they can go back to and won't have for some considerable time, by getting more, I guess, rigorous in policing who the migrants are, by saying to Iranians, to Afghans, to people from the Western Balkans, Indonesians, you're really not our problem. You will have to go back.
I don't know if that's necessarily the solution, really, because actually, if you look at what Macedonia has done, shutting down their border to all Afghans, so they're sort of theoretically allowing Syrians and Iraqis through, but I think Iraqis, certainly Syrians, and just sort of locking the border down to Afghans, which is firstly causing huge delays, secondly causing huge scenes of suffering at the Greek border and people being stuck there. I think we enter quite a dangerous game if that's what we do. I think what you can do is to arrange sort of resettlement programs that perhaps prioritize people who are coming from Syria and Iraq, since that's where the incredibly acute problems are. But I mean, I think this is, it's unfortunately a short amount of time to discuss an incredibly complicated problem. But I think one of the many, many, many problems with the discussion around the refugee crisis is this real squeamishness about acknowledging the fact that this isn't just about Syria and it isn't just about Iraq. And yes, that's sort of drastically worsened the situation, this horrendous civil war that's led to the displacement of millions. But That's on top of, as Robert was saying earlier, it's on top of a sort of steady flow of refugees from other countries that's been building up over the last few years. And what we're seeing now is not just the result of the Syrian civil war, it's the result of decades of absolutely terrible policy building.
Okay, well, we will move on to a related question, which is that whether a ceasefire in Syria could be in sight. According to the country's president, Bashar al-Assad, yes, or after a fashion. Fresh from a phone call with Russia's Vladimir Putin, Assad appeared ready to respect the deal brokered by Moscow and Washington. Robert, as of course you know, the ceasefire does not include the ongoing campaigns against Islamic State, the al-Nusra Front, or anybody else that both Putin and Assad appeared not to like. Does it actually really mean anything?
I think it does, because I think that the way that both Putin and Obama were prepared to put their names to it, and Kerry and Lavrov worked very, very hard on this. And I think that Putin may have been spelling out a grim reality to Assad, because if the Ba'athist regime, even as a rump state, is to remain in a part of Syria, which is what Russia wants, then Assad and his immediate clique may very well have to go. That is the big change, that Assad is prepared to engage. Enough of the opposition is prepared to engage in talks, because the stakes are very, very high. And the problem is in the middle is the broad band, and they're very, very mixed indeed, of the Sunni Arab population of Syria. Do they, in desperation, turn to ISIS as their only protector? Where I think we've gone wrong, everybody, I don't quite take the view that our colleague Mary Duchevsky does, that I don't see Putin as altogether somebody who's transgressed against and a victim in this. But Putin, on the whole, in spite of everything, has been handled very, very badly, because his engagement has been absolutely vital on this. And one of the things where he has been traduced is that I'm damn sure that his Moscow sees ISIS as a main enemy, because we go on in the West, rightly, about radicals being recruited and going to the ISIS colours. But the Chechens, the people from Ingushetia, Dagestan, who are the real fighters and be giving a lot of muscle and direction to the fight of the conventional forces, and they fight very well, of the Islamic State, are a major threat to Russia. And that's why Russia must engage with that. The other thing I think that Putin is saying to Assad, you haven't got a blank check. We're not here forever. We can't go on supporting you for years, months at the most. We can give air support to your forces on the ground and so on. And I think that he is susceptible to world opinion, if not necessarily NATO-led Western opinion.
Samir, it does seem, and it's a question I've asked before, and it seems an increasingly absurd one every time I do it, but are there any grounds for optimism where Syria is concerned at this point, at least about this ceasefire, limited and circumscribed though it may prove to be?
I'm not hugely optimistic. I think that, you know, it's that sort of basic rule of conflict that neither side is going to agree to stop firing if they still think, in any sort of meaningful long-term way, if they think that they have a conceivable chance of victory. And I think that despite some sort of recent battlefield wins for the government side, I think both sides are still holding on to the hope that they might be able to get a decisive advantage. And I don't think those are that's not the context for a successful ceasefire, I don't think.
Is that, I mean, just finally on this, Robert, is that what's basically going on here, that both Assad and Putin think they can win this after a fashion? The rest of the world is coming around to the idea that if that's what it takes to get the war as such to stop, then okay.
They're ahead, but not in the way that the gloomsters in the West have been putting at it. I think there's another thing really going on, which is very, very serious indeed, acute at the moment. We've got the problems to the north. In Turkey, we can understand that, but there are real troubles in Lebanon, and I think that this is worrying the Arab world. The Arab world is in a mess over all of this, and I think that what is giving everybody pause for thought, including Putin himself, is the role of Iran, which has proved somewhat decisive. And is it really going to have a swing vote on the shores of the Mediterranean? That's the big question. And I am actually more optimistic than Samir. I do think that this will go somewhere. It won't be perfect, but I think they're going to try and work some diplomacy out of it.
It would be nice. Robert Fox and Samira Shackle, thank you for joining us. We will have to leave the discussions of the perils of Russian investment for another time. that is all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Our international playlist continues next at 1900 hours. Daniel Giacopelli has the entrepreneurs, and we'll have more on today's main stories on the daily at 2200. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, I'm Andrew Muller. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.